Hello, this is Kenneth Nichols with the Great Writers Deal podcast. Today, we are going to hear from Okla Elliott, the author of The Doors You Mark Are Your Own, a book co-authored with Raoul Clement, coming out from Dark House Press, an imprint of Curbside Splendor Publishing. It's a great book. You're going to enjoy the interview a great deal. He gives us a lot of things to think about. Smart people things like translation. Normal people things like how to build characters and how to build narratives. And best of all, you'll hear about how to write a book that, you know, people are going to want to read. This is going to be a big one. So go ahead and sit back, pour yourself a colortini, and let the literary ideas fly through the air. Because we'll be right back after this. Are you familiar with Neil Clark? He is the editor over at Clark's World, a very cool science fiction market. He recently went through his submission system to find out the commonest titles that people assign to their stories. I thought this interesting because I have to say I'm a little bit guilty of a few of these titles. We'll see what you think. The fifth most common title was Lost and Found. Fourth was Monsters. Third place was The Box. Second place was The Gift. Followed by Home, Hunger, and Homecoming. And the number one title out of all the stories submitted to Clark's World was Dust. Now, there's nothing wrong inherently with giving a story any title, but what do we lose when we give a story a title that has been used so much? On the other hand, do we lose people when we give a story a title that's a little bit too creative? I guess that the point is to try to come up with the perfect title for our story, the title that evokes the subject matter of the piece and offers the reader a reason to start reading. Do you find yourself falling into the trap of coming up with the same titles for your stories? Leave a comment to give us some of your insight into how you construct titles. One guy who has no trouble coming up with titles or doing much of anything else, in my view, is Okla Elliott, the subject of our interview today. Okla happens to be one of my compatriots from the Ohio State MFA program, and I have to say that he's one of those guys who just does it all, and it's really easy to be jealous of him if you don't respect him so much. As writers, we're inherently insecure because there are a finite number of places that you can publish a finite number of slots, and people are going to take those up, and sometimes those people are not us. How do we get through those times of self-doubt when we're not sure why we should go on, when we see everyone around us being successful, or at least it feels that way? For me, I really try to remember that a rising tide lifts all boats. Okla's doing really well. That's a great sign for literature because he writes some really cool stuff that is a lot of fun and extremely literary, for whatever that means. That's a recurring theme on the show. The thing that we need to steal from Okla, above all, as you'll see from my interview, is that he has an infinite curiosity about all kinds of different subjects. He really cares about a lot of different things, and that's very important. He also produces a great deal. He's the editor of Mayday Magazine. He does a lot of work for As It Ought to Be, another online magazine, in addition to writing his own books, stories. The guy's just doing all kinds of stuff, and that's the kind of thing that we should cultivate in ourselves. So without further ado, let's have a listen to my interview with Okla Elliott. Hello! We are here with Okla Elliott. He is the author of the forthcoming fantastic book, The Doors You Mark Are Your Own, from Dark House Press. That's an imprint of Curbside Splendor, a very cool publishing house out of Chicago. I believe that's correct, right?
Yes.
Very cool. So, thank you very much, Okla. How are you today?
Excellent. How are you?
I'm doing all right. I have to say, I really enjoyed the book, and if you could, would you mind giving us the elevator pitch for it?
Well, it's a post-apocalyptic novel, but it's also, and definitely science fiction, but what we're hoping to do is kind of raise the literary bar a bit on that kind of writing and try to get all the sort of plot stuff that we love from that kind of a novel, but also add in, you know, all the sort of character development and, you know, language sort of attention that you get from a literary novel, you know, whatever strict literary genre writing. We also added in some pomo fun, You know, we claimed Alexander Tuvim wrote the novel, and that Okla Elliott and Roel Clement, or fictional versions of us, rather, to be more exact, translated it. The Okla Elliott and Roel Clement who translate it are in the Federated States of America after the Great Calamity, and, you know, they're at the recently rebuilt University of Illinois, and they're just translators of this fictional Alexander Tuvim. So basically, we have a fictional author and then fictional versions of us who translated it. So again, we tried to raise the bar a little bit, sentence by sentence and character by character. So we added some kind of, you know, almost like David Foster Wallace kind of, you know, postmodern fun.
Well, it's interesting that you say that. What do you feel, you don't have to name any names if you don't want, but what do you feel is lacking in terms of literary quality in the traditional post-apocalyptic science fiction novel?
Well, I think what is generally called genre writing, though I hate that term, I think that it is, I mean, if we're talking a crime novel, a legal thriller, horror, whatever, sci-fi fantasy, I think that traditionally plot has been privileged over character development and, you know, again, sentence by sentence sort of, you know, beautiful, lush writing, you know, and you just don't find that as often. Now, someone could say that the literary genre, which is just one more genre to my mind, privileges language sometimes over plot, and that's why, you know, it's not as readily consumed by the public. And so, you know, the goal here is to do what's called slipstream and just bring the best of both worlds, basically. You know, like, why not have a plot and, you know, three-dimensional characters? Why not have a good plot and, you know, careful sentence writing, you know?
One of the things that I found interesting was that you have, and Mr. Clement, both of you in co-translating the novel, have a lot on your plate. How did you approach constructing the conceit of the novel while also constructing the narrative of the novel?
Well, the conceit, it's interesting. So years and years ago, we actually wrote an experimental play set kind of in a version of this world. We wrote a screenplay. Then we decided it was too big for that. But the way the idea came about is we were just sort of chatting about, like, oh, let's write some kind of a play or screenplay thing. And Roel was like, well, let's set it in Hollywood. I was like, well, I don't know if I want to set something in Hollywood. What if we do what Bertolt Brecht did with The Rise and Fall of the City of Mahagoni, where he takes Nazi Berlin and, you know, gangland, you know, gangster era Chicago and blends them into one city and calls it Mahagoni. I was like, why not take, you know, Soviet Russia, Nazi Berlin, and Golden Age Hollywood and blend that into one place called Joshua City? And we both immediately jumped on the idea, you know, so that's how the conceit happened. And then as for writing it, we used so many different methods. We used Google Docs. There was times when we lived in different states, so we'd be on the phone a lot. Then we've been living here together in Illinois for the past 2 years, and so sometimes we'd write side by side, one of us pacing around, sort of, you know, spouting off ideas manically while the other one was typing. So we switched up the tactics a lot, and we switched up the conceit a lot. Like I said, it started out an experimental play, then a screenplay, and now, you know, a novel.
Oh, definitely. I'm curious, what do you feel is the difference between the narrative of the piece in contrast with the conceit? Because you take on, you know, you, Okla Elliott, take on several roles in the book. You're ostensibly the translator of the book. You're also in the guise of Alexander Tuvim, and you're in a million other kind of minds in the book. How did you navigate telling the story through a number of perspectives which are, in a way, your own?
Well, I mean, it's interesting. I think it was a little bit easier to have two people writing it, because if you have a bunch of characters, as I mean, it's a cliche to say we sort of build our characters out of ourselves or the people we know. But if you have two people who have two personalities and, you know, two sets of people they know, you know, it's easier to be like, oh, I would like to sort of roughly, you know, put these characteristics from whatever, this friend of mine, you know, one characteristic of me, one characteristic of a friend, one characteristic of a character in a TV show I like, and then we all would do the same. And so we were able to sort of hodgepodge together a lot of different character types, I think, because of that.
Well, you mentioned the world building. A lot of people, you know, are constructing severely alternate worlds, although I guess every writer is making their own world when they write any story. But you mentioned how, obviously, you're picking a lot from Soviet Russia, you're picking a lot from other places. What was your approach to building the unique world of Joshua City in the book?
I think in that case, especially when you're building an alternate history or whatever you want to call it, it's an interesting kind of exercise in following things to their logical conclusion, right? So it's like, well, if that were to happen, then that would mean this would happen, then this would have to be the case, right? And so you have to do a lot of that kind of thinking. It's like, well, would there... one thing that we dealt with was with gender issues, right? And so we're like, well, in this post-apocalyptic world, would they allow women in engineering school? Well, not very often, right? We have one character who's like, hey, try to be a woman in engineering here. It's already bad in contemporary America. So imagine a post-apocalyptic world, right? And so we set those sorts of things up, you know, some of the gender issues, and then immigrant issues. So there's the seven cities. Joshua City is one of seven. And so they're immigrants from other cities. And Joshua City's kind of the America, as it were. It's the richest and most technologically advanced. And so we dealt with some racism, too. We have, you know, some immigrants from Baekyongdo, which is another city, which is, you know, vaguely Korean-based. I love their culture. I've studied some Korean language and culture, so we funhouse mirrored that a little bit. And so, again, it's a lot about just following things to their logical conclusion. Like, if this were to happen, would this be the case or would this other thing be the case? And just sitting down and, like, you know, be honestly letting the dominoes fall where they would.
One thing that I really loved about the book is that even though, complicated is the wrong word because that sounds imposing, but it's extremely well thought out, but you made it extremely accessible. Because the book, even though we talked about genre and you mentioned you wanted to raise the bar, the book, it's a prison break novel, it's a road novel, it's a book about revolution, it's a disease thriller in some ways, and clearly an alternate, you know, future history book. What are the ways in which, you know, including language, that you raised the bar on this and made it accessible while also making it complicated and complex?
Well, okay, so I have a little pet theory that I hope isn't too complicated, but I think that there's two ways to do complexity in literary writing. You can front-load it real heavy, right? So someone like Thomas Pynchon or Gaddis, right, they front-load their complexity. So to just like on the surface, to break through, just even reading a whole paragraph sometimes is hard, right? But then there's another way to do it, which is to backload it, right? So have your sentences be clean and, you know, breezy to read. But then it's like, you know, later when you're, you know, whatever, in the shower, eating dinner or whatever, you're still thinking about, why did that character do that? Or what an interesting little image that was, you know? And so what we try to do is backload as much of our complexity as possible and make the surface language as inviting as possible while not dumbing it down at all. I don't think, you know, someone like, I don't know, John O'Hara or Joyce Carol Oates, I mean, they're eminently readable, yet I don't think anyone's going to say they're not complex writers. So I think that's the real key there, is backloading that complexity. And you know, also, since we are trying to play with the genre aspects, you know, the science fiction genre aspects, you know, we want it to be, you know, readable. And so there's also ways to construct paragraphs, right? I mean, you know, don't write three-page paragraphs that are all one sentence. You know what I'm saying? Again, Gaddis or...
That.
Yeah, I mean, I love some writers who do it. I mean, again, Gaddis, Gass, Volman, these are some of my favorite writers, but we didn't want that kind of a novel for this, you know.
Well, one of the things that I thought made the book extremely readable, which is kind of like when they call a soda drinkable, and you're like, right. Well, of course it's drinkable, but what made the book readable is the way that you and Mr. Clement kind of fast forward through certain things, but you know when to pause. For example, when Adrian is in the he's taking care of people in the hospital toward the middle of the book, and he's waiting out the month to see if he wants to stay. That part, you know, we don't need to see every minute of that time, that deliberation period. But I really, really loved the subplot with I was thinking Arya.
Yeah, Arya, but yeah.
Arya, yeah.
That's how I choose to pronounce it. But I mean, it's whatever.
Yeah, that's cool.
It's an alternate world. You can pronounce it any way you want.
There you go. I really loved that the way that you slowed down on those moments, and even though we're not seeing every moment of his day as he decides what he wants to do, instead we're getting all that information in the context of a kind of love story.
Right. Well, I mean, so medical science, as we call it there, plays a big role because, you know, our two main characters, Nicholas Kowalski and Adrian Talbot, are medical scholars, as we call them, at Joshua University. And then, as you say, Adrian goes out and helps in this hospital out in the desert. And so, you know, we wanted to have all, I mean, and we did a lot of medical research and tried to do things like find, well, what was heart medicine like in 1971? Because this world wouldn't be as advanced as ours technologically or, you know, medically. And so we did a lot of research on, like, early heart transplant stuff and tried to recreate that, but also change it a bit, because the way they would create that science would be different. And but we didn't want to get bogged down, and we didn't want to turn it into, like, a science text, you know. And so those sorts of things that I like to think add a little bit of authority when someone's really done their research on those matters. But I've read some what's called hard sci-fi that gets so bogged down in their scientific facts that it feels like a textbook. So yeah, it's hard to find that balance, and we struggle with that. But also, I mean, any writer deals with, you know, when to, you know, do exposition and when to do scene, right? And so, you'll recall Erin McGraw at Ohio State University. She had a great actually, she gets a reference for this in the novel, actually. But she used to say a thing in class, like, remember when your parents used to tell you don't make a scene when you're at a restaurant and you're a little kid? What they mean is don't draw attention to us. And so her point was that a scene should only come in when you want to draw attention. So the default mechanism should actually be exposition. Just tell us what's going on, and then when you want to draw attention to something, that's when you stop and make a scene. And so we use that sort of dictum as our measure for when to stop and actually show an operation. You know, okay, well, this one we actually want to see. Okay, we can say, oh, Adrian did this, this, and this on throughout that week, you know, to sort of do it all exposition. Yeah, he met with this kind of a wounded soldier, this kind of a sick, you know, child, da-da-da. Then, oh, no, this one matters. Let's slow down and do it blow by blow. And so that was sort of the formula we used.
Yeah, I tend to think of it as the kind of shiny thing principle. You're walking along the street, it's a boring day, but the shiny things, you know, metaphorically in life are the things that you want to commit to paper, not the mundane things. If you don't mind, obviously we'll talk more about the novel. I want to reflect what you said through the lens of one of your short stories. You had a collection published by Press 53, a very cool independent press. And in a story like The Long Walk Home, you describe a veteran coming home from war. And it seemed to me while you were speaking that you did the same kind of thing where, you know, the flight is the same as everything else, and, you know, and it's not interesting. You had to cast the coming home of the protagonist, Reynolds, demonstrate what happened to him as he finally came home, the long walk home. So it's all about, like you said, figuring out which bits of the day, you know, and of the story are the ones that you want to cast attention on. Is there a difference when you're writing a shorter piece than a much longer piece in deciding what shiny things, what scenes you want to give the reader?
I mean, so a short sort of facile answer would just be no. You know, you have to use the same basic logic. But a more considered answer, I think, would have to take in genre. I mean, I think about genre constantly. And the genre, I mean, that's like maybe in manuscript form, I think that story was like 17 pages, you know what I'm saying? Whereas right. The novel in manuscript form was 958 pages.
It's, yeah, it's, yeah. It's,
so, I mean, you're going to have, I mean, in a big novel like that, you're just going to have to do a little bit more exposition. Whereas a short story, almost in and of itself, is like, you know, the day unlike any other, just to keep referencing our Ohio State faculty, Lee Martin used to always say that, you know, a short story, the reason why, you know, or your shiny thing, this was the shiny day, or this was the day that stood out. But as Lee Martin used to put it, the day unlike any other, right?
Right.
And so, you know, so as I say, a more considered answer is like, and if you look at that story, there's definitely, you know, plenty of exposition, but I'm going to say that that story, I mean, it's been years, but I'm going to say it's like 75% scene, whereas the novel is maybe 50% scene, just because you got to get a lot more data out, especially, once again, and when you're bringing in those science fictional and post-apocalyptic elements, sometimes you just got to let the reader know what the world's like. And you can do that through scene, and you definitely do that through scene. But every so often, you just got to give them a paragraph of, okay, look, this is what this was like. And so I think the in this sense of the word genre, from short story to novel, I do think that, and especially talking about this specific, you know, the Dorsey Mark Your Own, that novel, and The Long Walk Home, that short story specifically, I think the short story there sort of demanded a bit more scene. I will say, interestingly, it's interesting that you picked that one out. If you look at the acknowledgments, Raul helped me a lot with that story, to the point where I give him co-authorship on that story, too. So it's all the other stories in the novella in that collection are, you know, mine. I was about to say 100% mine, but that's nonsense. So many friends help you edit, so you're always collaborating. But that story was so Raul influenced that if you look at the acknowledgments, I actually give him co-authorship on that story. So it's interesting that you picked that one out, since obviously you and I co-wrote The Dorsey Mark Your Own.
Definitely, yeah. I'm looking now. Oh, yeah, it is interesting that I picked that out, yeah. You mentioned that you collaborated with him on The Long Walk Home.
Now, of course, pleasure. I mean, one of the things that I always point out is, you know, every story in that collection and every poem practically that I've written in the past decade, and same for Raul, we're each other's first editor on everything. This is why we were able to write a novel together. People are always asking, like, how can you write a novel with someone? And I always say, well, I couldn't do it with anyone else. Because, you know, he and I are, like, are each other's first go-to for everything literary. And so we always joke that we have a hive mind about these things, you know. The number of times I mentioned we'd be, like, typing side by side. And, you know, either I'd be the one pacing around or he'd be the one pacing around. And he would say something or I would say something. And the other one had typed, I mean, literally, the exact words that the person just said, but like a second before they said them. And we'd just be like, look, and we had always made a joke, you know, the hive doth thrive, you know. So it's interesting that you picked that one out, because I think, but as I say, every single poem, I mean, in The Cartographer's Ink, which came out in my poetry collection, there's not a poem in there that he didn't edit three times, you know. And same thing, every poem or story he's published, I've edited two or five times. So even those things that don't bear a double byline, you know, we're just all over each other's work. And everyone has two or three friends like that, you know, they show their work to. So I don't know. I think the sort of lone artist is a little bit of a romantic, capital R, idea that's a bit of hogwash to my mind, because we all collaborate in so many ways.
Well, interesting. Can you think of if an idea that that Mr. Clement just knocked down of yours, like a time where he, you know, probably rightly, you know, said no, let's not do that?
A specific example is actually hard to come up with, because we both like what would happen is it'd be a sort of like, he would throw out an idea, be like, well, let's have Nicholas do this. I'm like, no, I don't think that's believable. He's like, yeah, but I like this idea about it. I'm like, okay, well, let's keep that idea or that aspect of what you said, and then let's add this. He's like, yeah, I dig that. And then, you know, so 5 minutes later, whoever came up with the first idea, it's like it gets real fuzzy, you know what I'm saying? Because we just sort of Voltron together.
There you go, yeah.
You know, each different idea, and I'd be like, oh, well, to keep the Voltron metaphor, I'm like, well, let's take that arm off and put this other blue arm on, you know? So I guess what I would say is both of us knocked down and built up practically every single idea. One big one, I guess, was that we had about 70 pages of backstory on Vivian and Abraham, two of the characters in the Dorsey Mark Your Own husband-wife team. Vivian is a famous actress, and Abraham is the greatest engineer who develops these trains they become almost mythologized in the Joshuan culture. We had about 70 pages of backstory on them, and then very painfully had to cut it, and you know, and that was like in part one of the novel, and we reduced it to about 20 pages and made it backstory in part three because we just felt like it made part one too long, and it suddenly became this domestic drama. But that was a hard one, you know. That was tough. And again, there was one of these things where we went back and forth, and eventually just had to decide, yeah, that those pages have to go.
Well, what do you think is a skill that you feel that you have, and a skill that you feel he has?
It's interesting. I feel one thing that I know that happened a lot is especially when we're on the phone, when we're living in he's in North Carolina, I was in Illinois, is that like you know whatever, he'd be writing on something and he'd hit a certain roadblock, and I'd be like, well, what if we just restructure it like this, and then within like, you know, 20 minutes, you know, the roadblock's gone and the novel's moving forward again. So that's sort of like structuring of narrative. I felt like I brought a lot to the table. Though, of course, he did too. I mean, he had lots of great structural ideas. Roel has an almost genius level ability to like describe a little scene. It's almost, it borders on like the Nabokovian, you know, the way that like he'll just like find exactly the right sort of descriptor for a thing that like you know exactly when the hand moves exactly that way, you know the person's sad without having to be like, you know, John moved his hand sadly. It's like the exact way he moved his hand, and you just know and you feel it. I think he has, as I say, something that borders on the Nabokovian for that.
Oh, very cool. One of the things that I think elevated the novel above the typical genre stuff, even though, you know, we both love genre, were some of the ways that you condensed the narrative, but also shared it in an interesting way. For example, in part one, there's a really nice cinematic technique where Marchik's mother is writing a letter to him, and you intersperse a bit of narration in sections between, in the middle of the letter. So you're getting all that exposition out and the characterization, but you're also kind of metaphorically shifting the lens, you know, taking the camera and putting it somewhere else to cut things down a little bit. Another technique that you used are the footnotes. The book has, don't sound scared if you haven't read the book, but especially toward the beginning, there are footnotes to disperse the exposition in an extremely fast manner. Were these conscious decisions to condense the exposition in this way? What else do you feel that you guys did?
Well, I'm glad that you point that out, because we didn't want to just always do what I call like a data dump, right? And that's one thing I find a lot in some of the more like, you know, again, I hate the term, but we got to use it. It's the language around us. Some of the more purely genre kind of writing that I love reading. I mean, even like, you know, the, you know, infinite genius of Asimov, you know, Isaac Asimov, every so often he would just give you a page that was just like, okay, now I'm just going to tell you all this stuff and you're just going to have to deal with it, you know what I'm saying?
Right.
And every so often, that, like I said, it feels like a data dump. So we thought we would switch up the tactics. So we have, you know, these sort of governmental documents that will sometimes be brought in, and then Alexander Tuvum has the occasional footnote, but then the fictional Oakley Elliott and Ronald Clement as translators of Tuvum will every so often just jump in and be like, oh, you know, we had to translate that word this way because the way the culture worked then, and it, then suddenly in like three sentences you learn all this stuff about the culture, but again, it doesn't, we switched up the tactics for getting you that kind of data that you need when you're building a, you know, an alternate world. And so, yeah, we used, you know, Joshua City government documents, we used letters, we used footnotes from both the author and the fake author and fake translators. And then we use just, you know, classic, you know, and now we're going to give you a paragraph of exposition where you just learn that's what's up with the water or whatever. So I think the hope there, the very conscious hope, yes, if it was conscious, it certainly was, the hope was to switch up the tactics enough so it didn't feel like every 10 pages you were getting hit with like the same kind of technique for getting you that necessary information.
Yeah, definitely. I wonder if you feel that there's a difference in the speed of the narrative and the way that you felt composing it as you went along. Once that's how I felt reading it. Once the kind of exposition is out of the way and I understand the characters and what's going on and where they're living, the book read faster to me. Is it written faster metaphorically, or how does that work?
Well, I mean, I think you're right. I mean, one reviewer, Booklist, gave us a pretty positive review, but then they made this one little thing like, I think they phrased it as a lot of these, you know, big, you know, science fiction books go. It starts out a little slow, but it picks up speed. You know, like, reader, you know, don't stop reading. What's interesting is another reviewer actually preferred the first part, but whatever, reviewers are fickle. But I think you're right that it's just a function of developing a world. You know, at first you're like, where am I? And once you, it's almost like, you know, go be a tourist in, you know, Turkey or Germany or Egypt or something for a week. Your first day is just, you know, like, oh, well, where do I even get a sandwich? And then after 4 or 5 days, you're just walking down the street getting your sandwich. Oh, that's where I like to get my coffee, you know. And you know, going, you're almost a tourist in this new world when you read a big, you know, fantasy or sci-fi novel. And so it takes a little while to figure out the lay of the land. And then once you get it, then it's easier. And also, we have to do less work, right? I mean, early on, we have to tell you, oh, that's the name of that city. Oh, that's, you know, the language they speak. That's the economic situation over there. That here's the political situation in Joshua City. But after 50 or 100 pages, you kind of, again, basically know the lay of the land. You keep learning more and more things, and we travel out into the desert and, you know, the outer provinces, as we call them, in the second part of the novel. So you're still learning new parts of the world. But again, you kind of got your bearings. And so I think it's more of an effect of that. And I think it's true, as the Booklist reviewer said, this is just true of, I mean, practically every science fiction or fantasy novel out there. It takes a little while to sort of, you know, if you're reading Harry Potter, it's like, how do the spells work, you know? Well, you know, it takes you 100 pages to know how the spells work. And then once you do, the writer doesn't have to give you as much information, so there's fewer words to read about that. But then even when they do, you're like, oh, yeah, I know that. And so you kind of breeze by it, as opposed to like, what? How does this work again? So I think it's just a function of the genre.
Yeah, I don't think the book starts out slowly. I think that you understand when you pick up a book, you know, of this kind of heft, you know what you're in for. You know, it's right. It's not, you're not going to read this and then take your kid to soccer practice because, you know, you won't have time. Right. But you will curl up on a, you know, a nice evening, get a cup of coffee and dig in. I think that's just something that we, you know, it's part of the deal.
Well, I mean, actually, and part of the plan of having it come out in mid-April, so it's coming out in like 2 weeks, is that, you know, the reviews will be coming out and people will be reading and stuff, but about a month after it comes out, school's out and it's summertime. And I do think this is the kind of book that, I mean, you don't read it on your lunch break and you're done. It's the kind of book that you're like, okay, I got a week off of work. I'm going to, you know, put my pajamas on and order a pizza and just like lie in bed all day and just sort of get immersed. And, you know, I love novellas. I love short stories. I love poetry. But I mean, my favorite experience as a reader, and I hope we've created this for readers, is exactly that. Like, you know what? Today I am doing nothing. I'm just going to read this thing and just like lose myself in this other world all day or all weekend or whatever, all spring break, all, you know, whatever.
Well, speaking of poetry and other worlds, I wanted to talk briefly about, you do a lot of translation work.
Right.
And I was curious about your thoughts on translation, especially in the context of The Doors You Mark Are Your Own. When you translate, you're inherently trying to communicate another person's thoughts that were translated into words. You're trying to translate those through another language, through your own brain, into words in another language. What are your thoughts on the accuracy, the philosophy when you engage in such an act?
Well, I mean, first off, I mean, there's a reason why Umberto Eco, the great Italian novelist, anthologist, called translation the art of failure, because it is. I mean, translation is just not going to be perfect. But that's part of, I don't know, it's almost like that's why I love it. You know, it's like, I know I'm going to fail, but can I, you know, to keep quoting people, as Becca says, can I fail better? You know what I'm saying? So you translate, you're like, oh, well, I can't quite get that bit of linguistic oddity. So I primarily translate Jürgen Becker, the German poet, and I have his selected shorter poems. It's coming up from Black Lawrence Press later this year. And, you know, he does, you know, as a lot of poets do, he does, like, you know, little linguistic oddities. And if the poet's doing his job right, or her job in this case, a he, but whatever, if the poet, if poets are doing their job right, they're pushing their language to its boundaries, which means they're using every technique that that language allows, and not every language allows the same techniques, right? So I'd be like, okay, well, he could do that in that line in German. I can't do that in that line in English, but in the next line, I can do something kind of like it. So it's almost like I owed him a syntactical oddity, and I just keep a ledger almost of what do I owe Becker's poem, you know? But it's great fun. I sometimes joke that, you know, some people do the New York Times Sunday crossword puzzle. I translate poetry. You know, it's so fun to try to, like, get those things to fit in and to, you know, how do you get them to work? And then also, like, how do you deal with, like, a cultural reference that, you know, that culture would totally get, but no one else would. So, I mean, if you say Cape Cod or Martha's Vineyard in, you know, the U.S., we all know, oh, okay, rich people are there. But, I mean, does someone in Germany know Martha's Vineyard from Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania? Probably not, you know what I'm saying? And so how do you deal with that? These terms that are loaded culturally, but, you know, so then you give a quick little gloss, you know what I'm saying? The ritzy, blah, 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 you know, if it's the name of a hotel that everyone would in that culture know is a ritzy hotel, I mean, maybe you have to add a word so that the reader in the new culture gets the valence, you know? So, no, it's a game of give and take, and it is, you know, the art of failure at Echo Culture.
And what's the kind of level of fluency that you feel a translating poet should have?
Well, this is one area where I am a little bit conservative, you know, because, I mean, I've been in Mexico, you know, several times, and my Spanish is decent. You know, I've studied French since I was, like, 18 years old. But I more or less don't let myself translate those languages I'm weaker in. You know, I have a degree in German. I lived in Germany for a full year, and I've been back a couple times. So I feel like you need a really high level, honestly. And this is why you get translating teams a lot, right? You'll get, like a scholar who, you know, just knows the language perfectly, and then a really skilled poet in English, right? And they'll team up because I find that the two ways the translation can go wrong is that you end up with someone who's like, you know, he or she is just amazing at the language and the culture, but you know, it has never written a masterful poem in their own language. So they have really accurate, you know, translations, but they're also kind of bloodless. Or they can go the other way, right? Someone who doesn't know the language very well, but is an excellent poet, and they just take all these crazy liberties or just make outright errors and end up with a beautiful poem. It's just not an accurate one. So no, I think you gotta, the bar is pretty high for me on that one. You gotta either team up and get both of those skills together, or, you know, the one person has to publish some of their own work and actually really know the language.
Yeah, I agree with you. I do think that a poet or a, you know, a writer can get something interesting out of the misunderstandings they might have in the other language, as long as they're not kind of claiming that they're doing a translation. You know, it can be inspiring,
right.
But maybe not so much a translation. Yeah, very cool. I like to ask people, you're very much a literary person, doing lots of things, living in Germany, not currently, but at times. And so you must have an independent bookstore or two, a place that you feel does that right. What are you thinking?
Here locally, I like Jane Addams Bookstore quite a bit. They sell used books and new books, but they're also super supportive of local authors. They'll, like, you just walk in and say, hey, I'm a local author, here are two of my books, and they'll just write you a check for them and put them on the you know, local author stack. And obviously, I mean, University of Illinois has a lot of writers, so it's a nice stack that they have over there. And then also, you know, it's again, it's a beautiful little place too. You know, it's like you walk in, you're like, oh, I am happy to be here. You know, if you're having a bad day, you walk in, you're gonna have a better day. You know.
Well, very much, yeah. There are. And I wanted to make sure that people know the Cartographers Inc. If you liked what Mr. Elliott said about poetry and about translation and language, definitely pick up his really interesting book, The Cartographers Inc., published by NYQ Books recently, and it's on your website, so there's no point in not saying it, but a big fan of the book is Joyce Carol Oates herself. Then that must have felt really good to get validation from someone like that.
Well, I mean, first of all, she's one of my favorite writers. I probably own, I don't know, 30 or 40 of her books. It's almost an obsession to read her books. But also, she's part of my dissertation. But yeah, no, and it's interesting that you bring up the language stuff, because when she praised it on her Twitter page, you know, she read it and, you know, praised it publicly, which, yeah, I mean, I almost fainted, you know. But she talked about the... I'm surprised I don't have this memorized. I don't, but I'm kind of surprised. But
I have it in front of me if you want.
Do, because she said something about the languages thing, like the ease and through, you know what I'm saying? It's like,
yeah.
But even though it's all in English, somehow she intuited that, you know, I'm into translation and foreign languages or something, you know?
Yeah, she says, thanks to Okla Elliott for The Cartographer's Ink, which moves with unsettling ease through space/time/languages, a melancholy beauty.
Right, exactly, yeah, that move through languages, you know, is, when I read it, it was interesting. I mean, I don't know what she knows about me, you know what I'm saying? She's probably a pretty busy lady. But I don't know if she even knows I'm a translator, but somehow she could smell on my own poetry that I spent a lot of time with poetry in other languages. So I thought that, I mean, of course, she's an observant and brilliant lady, so no mystery there. But I did think it was interesting that she sort of intuited that.
Yeah, one of the things that I don't have the book on hand, but one of the things that I love about your poetry is that it is accessible, and it's you know, again, readable, but it's also got that flavor of otherness in that kind of way that may have clued her into languages, because even though it's, you know, it's very easy to read, you're talking about, you know, living elsewhere, you're talking about people like smart scholar people from long ago. References that you know that people either will get or look up. What's the mixture in terms of being understandable and being how do you approach language in a poem that gets people to understand but also challenges them?
This is interesting. This obviously came up earlier when we're talking about the novel and how we've, you know, added in all this sort of high literary stuff without, you know, trying to be off-putting in any way. And I think my little pet theory about you can front-load or back-load your complexity, and I just think you can be just as complex as, you know, whatever, James Joyce, without being as immediately impenetrable. You know what I'm saying? And again, I love Joyce. I love all these difficult authors. They're all over my bookshelves, and I've learned a lot from them. But if anything, one thing I learned is not a lot of people are going to be willing to, you know, read a 800-page prose poem, basically, you know, high lyricism for 800 pages. So I think my goal is, it's almost like a little challenge I give myself. Like, can I be as complex as William H. Gass, but as readable as Isaac Asimov in the novel? You know what I'm saying? And the same thing with the poetry, you know. I just don't see any reason. And I think some people do it... do that sort of like surface level difficulty to kind of show how smart and amazing they are or something. It's like they're begging you to see them that way. Whereas if, you know, some people get overlooked if they're a little more readable, but I think you can find a middle ground where, again, you can have certain difficulties on the surface, but also have a lot of inviting aspects to the surface.
Oh, very much. There are a few questions that I ask all the writers. First of all, how do you usually compose your first drafts? It may be different for you because you collaborate a lot, but what is that procedure generally like?
Once again, we have to come back to genre. Poems tend to, like, you know, since, first off, they're shorter. I mean, sometimes, I mean, if I write an 11-line poem, I'll just be walking down the street to get my cup of coffee, and bam, I've got a cool little idea. And that's half of the poem already. So those tend to come pretty fast. Otherwise, I'm a pretty slow writer. I try to write every day, but the actual pace of getting words on page is, you know, like 2 pages a day. You know what I'm saying? It's like nothing spectacular. So for a story or an essay, something a little bit longer, again, I do tend to get that flash of idea, and so I pound out those first couple pages pretty fast. Then I'm going to, like, slowly develop the rest of it. There's no way to talk about a novel, really. I mean, I'm working on a new novel now. I've got about 100 pages on it, called Salt of the Earth. That's sort of mixing crime, legal writing with the literary genre again. Like, so it seems like all my novels are going to end up... Actually, I've never conceived of a purely literary novel, to be honest. There's always some genre element. I don't know why that is, because that's not true of my short stories, necessarily. So that's quite a bit different. What might sound like a cop-out answer is it changes project to project and genre to genre so much that it's hard to give one template, as it were.
Oh, sure. And so once you have something down, what is your revision procedure as variable?
Yeah, I mean, well, okay, so of course I fail, like we all do, with our writing goals, but I more or less hit this, you know, 5 or 6 days a week, where I try to produce 2 new pages and edit 8 to 10 old ones. So I'm like, I'm editing as I'm writing constantly, and it'll get me back into the process. So especially with, like, a novel, what I'll do is I'll go, you know, so whatever I wrote on Monday, on Tuesday, I go, like, 3 or 4 pages back even before what I wrote on Monday, edit that, edit what I wrote on Monday, and then now I'm in the flow again, and then I get my 2 new pages, right? And then the next day, the goal is to go back, comb through all that yet again, get myself back into the flow, make changes as necessary, and then keep going forward. So it's a constant editing process. Then, of course, you know, with the longer project, you hit those awful moments where, like, you know, as I was saying earlier, where we had to cut 70 pages from Georgie Mark Your Own, and those moments, you know, it's just like, you know, you almost want to lie down in a fetal position and cry because you, you know, painstakingly created this huge movement, and you gotta cut it, you know. Sorry, you know. So that tends to be my process for prose. Poetry, I just read it. Since, again, I mean, I actually occasionally will write, like, the 10-page poem, but mostly I do the 1 to 4 pagers, you know. Right. And those, you just read beginning to end over and over again until that, you know, it's finally get right.
Very cool. Once you have especially a smaller piece ready to go in your view, what is your submission procedure generally like?
You know, I've been trying to get better about this over the years. Like, I know there are people who have, like, Excel spreadsheets for this stuff. I can't quite get there. But, I mean, you know, send it out to, you know, find the places that accept simultaneous submissions and shoot them out. I mean, I'm really bad about this stuff because, I mean, just recently I realized I have, like, 30 or 40 poems that I've, like, you know, edited, and they're as ready as they're going to be, and they've never been submitted once. I'm like, what are you doing, man? But then, you know, so then what happens is it's a lot of, it goes to extremes, right? So I'll kind of get angry at myself for having not done that, and I'll sit down and make up, you know, a couple packets of poems. I'm like, I'm going to submit, like, to 30 places today, you know? And so I go crazy one day, and then it's like, you know, 4 months later, I'm like, dude, you know, be a good shepherd for your work, you know. I'm not particularly functional at it, but, like, what I'm working toward is just sort of constantly having, you know, submissions out, and as things come back, just send them out to another place. You'd asked about, you know, any kind of, like, advice or whatever earlier for writers and stuff. I think the number one thing to do is just to develop the thickest skin ever. You know, I have a couple friends who are really talented writers, and they send stuff out, and they just, for whatever reason, people aren't picking it up. I don't get it. And I feel like I've been really lucky, you know. I mean, when I do sit down and do my, like, okay, this weekend I'm going to submit, you know, to 30 places or whatever, I get pretty good returns on that, and I feel like I've just been lucky. I mean, and this isn't any false modesty. I mean, I feel like my stuff did deserve to get published, or it wouldn't have been. But I have friends, I'm like, and I'm like, yeah, that's just as good. Why is no one picking that up? So I think you have to sort of, everyone has to admit the total randomness of this stuff. You know what I'm saying? It's like, if the person reading the slush pile that day is hungover, or, you know, her boyfriend or his girlfriend just, like, you know, or whatever, you know, if they just went through a breakup or they just found someone that fell in love for, you know, and you sent them a love poem, like, okay, well, that's going to be different, right? If they just, you know, had a horrible breakup, like, screw love, screw this poem, you know? If they're like, oh, life is beautiful, I just found Bob, you know? And the slush pile reader's thinking of Bob and, you know, how he or she loves Bob so much. And then you hit them with this beautiful love poem. They're like, that's exactly how I feel about Bob. I'm going to publish that. You know, I mean, I don't know if it's quite that random, but I mean, it kind of is, you know?
It's very much a mixture of the preparation and the hard work and a little bit of luck in the numbers game.
Exactly. That's exactly a numbers game. That's why every so often I get angry at myself and just, like, sit down and submit like a madman over one weekend, because I know it's a numbers game. You send out a short story once to the New Yorker, okay, your odds are slim.
Yeah,
you know what I'm saying? But if you send it to the Mid-American Review and Hayden's Fair Review and Black Warrior Review and, you know, seven others, and throw the New Yorker in there for fun, okay, well, your odds just went up drastically, you know what I'm saying?
Sure.
So it's just you know, you got to do the hard work. But then you have to admit it's also a numbers game. And so you got to be a good shepherd for your own work, but you also have to just not take it as a reflection on yourself. Because, like I said, I do. I mean, I know a lot of writers, and not all of us are you know, getting all that lucky. And I've watched people just sort of be like, you know, no one's ever going to publish my stuff, and then just stop submitting for like a year. I'm like, no, that's the opposite of what you need to be doing.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
You know, you get three rejections, okay, send out six more. You know what I'm saying? Like, it's resilience and perseverance, you know.
Oh, definitely. And you have been in a bunch of dream journals yourself for other people, but is there that dream journal that you really want to be in, Dream Magazine?
You know, it's crazy, man, but it's Alaska Quarterly Review for me. Yeah, Alaska Quarterly, man.
They're great, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, and they're amazing, but it's like, I think a lot of people might say, oh, Paris Review, right? Not, don't get me wrong, I'd love to be in Paris Review. If the editors of Paris Review are listening right now, give me a call. But but it's like when I've submitted to Paris Review like twice in my life, but Alaska Quarterly like a dozen times, and they just won't, and they give me a nice rejection. They say, hey, we really like this. But yeah, I don't know why I do know why I love that journal, because I've bought, you know, a couple dozen copies of it over the past decade, and just hands down, just like everything in there is just always amazing. And so I've gotten weirdly obsessed, and probably because they've continued to reject me over and over and over again. I'm like, no, you must be mine.
They're not my number one rejected journal, but they're up there. But they, because they do excellent work, you know, you keep trying with them.
Mm-hmm.
Very cool. Yeah. What's one of your, because, you know, you're always doing a lot of stuff, do you have any narrative guilty pleasures like reality TV or Breaking Bad or anything like that?
I mean, I watch Netflix like it's my job, and also I use it for research, or I tell myself maybe, that I do a lot of research with it. So when we're writing a Dorothy Market Your Own, you know, I mean, I watched every single sci-fi TV show and movie on Netflix and Amazon Prime possible, you know? And now that I'm working on this crime legal, you know, literary, you know, novel, I'm watching, you know, I recently watched the TV show Philly, which breaks my heart. I only got one season. It's such a great show. And I'm watching The Good Wife right now, too. Like, it's my job. Yeah, it's a great show. And it's one of those shows that's like, again, it blends. I mean, it's legally as accurate as any TV show is going to be. You know what I'm saying? I mean, they take liberties because you have to sometimes. But it's pretty legally accurate. But it's also just so dramatically rich. I mean, it's kind of like The Wire, which is another show I love. I mean, that's a crime show, like The Sopranos is a crime show. But they've raised the bar to be as good as any Pulitzer Prize-winning novel. You know what I'm saying? So in a way, I almost have too many guilty pleasures to name. But yeah, I do a lot of Netflix watching. It's also kind of how I reward myself at the end of the day, you know?
Oh, yeah, you definitely unwind that way. Who are some of you, you've worked with many great people, both as student and teacher, but who are some of the mentors that you've had along the way?
Well, I mean, Lee Martin, who is, I would consider one of my mentors, I used to joke every essay I ever workshopped in one of his classes ended up published. So I need to, like, just, you know, go do a Lee Martin workshop every so often and you know, my nonfiction career will blow up. But Lee used to joke that I was the fastest person to ever accept admission to OSU's MFA program, and it's because that was my number one program, because Andrew Hudgens is, to my mind, one of the, like, three or four greatest poets. And it turns out he's also a great teacher, you know? I mean, that doesn't always mix, right? You can be a great writer and kind of suck as a teacher, but so for, but then Lee K. Abbott's there as well, so it's like those three guys definitely are my sort of triumvirate. But I mentioned Erin McGraw earlier, too, and she, you know, taught me so much. I said she gets a reference in the novel. Alexander Tuvim sort of parrots some of her literary thinking, as I mentioned earlier. So I would say that probably those four, like, really, developed me a lot as a writer at Ohio State. Some people, I find that, I mean, in this whole MFA debate thing that goes on constantly, annoyingly, one thing that people don't talk about is, like, a lot of people talk trash about their MFA experience. You know what I'm saying? It's like, do you do an MFA or not? Are you a real writer or not? And then people just keep going back and forth with those two stupid ideas. But, I mean, it's like, really, almost no one praises their MFA program. And I just, it's almost like they should be paying me how much I praise that program. Because, I mean, Andrew taught me so much about poetry. You know, and the two Lees, Lee K. Abbott and Lee Martin, taught me so much about prose and, you know, both fictional and non-fictional. And then Erin McGraw taught me tons. I mean, actually, the novella in From the Crooked Timber was workshopped in her class. So that was a big, first of all, it was a big commitment on her part to tackle that with me. I would say those people are definitely mentors. I just have a lot of buddies, too, as I say. You know, David Bowen started American Press with. You know, he and I talk about literature all the time, so that's more of a peer thing. Same thing with Raoul. So, yeah, I mean, that's another place where I just feel like I've just been really lucky. I went to OSU to work with, you know, a handful of people and found even more people I wanted to work with, and they were all amazing. Then, I have just, like, a ton of really, really good friends. I mean, Kyle Miner and I have collaborated on things before, and we've traded work off, and we, you know, just support each other in every way we can. And that, again, that's rare. A lot of writers are, basically, like, petty backstabbers, you know, something about the artist ego or something. But also, I mean, like, my friend Jillian Viza, you know, I mean, she's just, you know, ever since I met, actually, I don't know if I should tell the story, but I will, but I remember when I was living in Greensboro, she got a poem in Atlantic Monthly, and you would think she was in her MFA program there at the time, and I was doing another master's at the time, she got a poem in Atlantic Monthly, and you would think that everyone would just, like, be going crazy high-fiving her in the hallway, you know what I'm saying, confetti through the air.
Be thrilled, yeah.
But instead, it was not exactly ostracized, but it was just like, it was like, okay, that happened, whatever. I was like, you know, to hell with that. So I threw her a big party, you know what I'm saying? It's like, and so I think sometimes people do get petty about those sorts of things, you know. Someone gets lucky or, you know, works harder or whatever. And then they get a little jealous or something. But I would like to encourage anyone listening, don't be that person. You know what I'm saying? If your friend if your friend gets something good, buy him a taco and high five him. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Not to totally toot the horn of the Ohio State program. We both attended, and I'm sure that there were lapses from everybody on occasion because we're human. I always sensed a lot of support from people, and I've always been genuinely pleased and overjoyed when people have gotten fantastic success. It's not a zero-sum game.
Right, exactly. I mean, I that's one of the things I no way I could have predicted it, but one of the things I will say that's really great about the Ohio State MFA program is that they really foster that kind of thing. You know, if someone gets good news, they send it out over the listserv, and you know, there is kind of high-fiving in the hallway, you know, when someone gets into a great journal, you know, or gets a book contract. As you say, there are lapses, and there are different personalities, so, you know, it's not 100%, but you're not going to get that in any human endeavor. But, yeah, I mean, it's one of those programs that, you know, and then people talk about some other programs that are great, but I hear stories of just, like, really brutal competition, and it's like, well, that's not the environment I want to be in, even if it's, you know, whatever, equally well-ranked as Ohio State, or even better ranked, I'd rather be in that supportive environment.
Yeah, there's so much rejection and so much negativity inherent in writing. I don't like spreading it to other people, which is why I do, you know, all this Great Writers Steal stuff. We have the most important question, which is also the last one. What should we look for next from Okla Elliott?
Well, first, I would like to thank you for doing all the good work you do for writers like myself. You've been really supportive. So thank you. You're an excellent literary citizen.
Oh, thank you, yeah.
Then what to look for next? Well, I guess in 2 weeks, look for my novel. But then in December, I have the book of actual translation coming out. And as I say, I'm hoping that I can get this new novel, Salt of the Earth, done, or at least a draft of it done by the end of the year, and then start shopping it around. There's some talk of film rights for The Doors You Mark Your Own, so maybe you're going to be looking for a TV show or something, but that's up in the air right now. But, you know, the agent is optimistic, she says.
Oh, yeah, honestly, the book does lend itself well to that. It's it has that kind of... Hello, this is Kenneth Nichols with the Great Writers Deal podcast. Today, we are going to hear from Okla Elliott, the author of The Doors You Mark Are Your Own, a book co-authored with Raoul Clement, coming out from Dark House Press, an imprint of Curbside Splendor Publishing. It's a great book. You're going to enjoy the interview a great deal. He gives us a lot of things to think about. Smart people things like translation. Normal people things like how to build characters and how to build narratives. And best of all, you'll hear about how to write a book that, you know, people are going to want to read. This is going to be a big one. So go ahead and sit back, pour yourself a colortini, and let the literary ideas fly through the air, because we'll be right back after this. Are you familiar with Neil Clark? He is the editor over at Clark's World, a very cool science fiction market. He recently went through his submission system to find out the commonest titles that people assign to their stories. I thought this interesting because I have to say I'm a little bit guilty of a few of these titles. We'll see what you think. The fifth most common title was Lost and Found. Fourth was Monsters. Third place was The Box. Second place was The Gift, followed by Home, Hunger, and Homecoming. And the number one title out of all the stories submitted to Clark's World was Dust. Now, there's nothing wrong inherently with giving a story any title, but what do we lose when we give a story a title that has been used so much? On the other hand, do we lose people when we give a story a title that's a little bit too creative? I guess that the point is to try to come up with the perfect title for our story, the title that evokes the subject matter of the piece and offers the reader a reason to start reading. Do you find yourself falling into the trap of coming up with the same titles for your stories? Leave a comment to give us some of your insight into how you construct titles. One guy who has no trouble coming up with titles or doing much of anything else, in my view, is Okla Elliott, the subject of our interview today. Okla happens to be one of my compatriots from the Ohio State MFA program, and I have to say that he's one of those guys who just does it all. And it's really easy to be jealous of him if you don't respect him so much. As writers, we're inherently insecure because there are a finite number of places that you can publish, a finite number of slots, and people are going to take those up, and sometimes those people are not us. How do we get through those times of self-doubt when we're not sure why we should go on, when we see everyone around us being successful, or at least it feels that way? For me, I really try to remember that a rising tide lifts all boats. Okla's doing really well. That's a great sign for literature because he writes some really cool stuff that is a lot of fun and extremely literary, for whatever that means. That's a recurring theme on the show. The thing that we need to steal from Okla, above all, as you'll see from my interview, is that he has an infinite curiosity about all kinds of different subjects. He really cares about a lot of different things, and that's very important. He also produces a great deal. He's the editor of Mayday Magazine. He does a lot of work for As It Ought to Be, another online magazine, in addition to writing his own books, stories. The guy's just doing all kinds of stuff, and that's the kind of thing that we should cultivate in ourselves. So without further ado, let's have a listen to my interview with Okla Elliott. Hello, We are here with Okla Elliott. He is the author of the forthcoming fantastic book, The Doors You Mark Are Your Own, from Dark House Press. That's an imprint of Curbside Splendor, a very cool publishing house out of Chicago. I believe that's correct, right?
Yes.
Very cool. So thank you very much, Okla. How are you today?
Excellent. How are you?
I'm doing all right. I have to say, I really enjoyed the book, and if you could, would you mind giving us the elevator pitch for it?
Well, it's a post-apocalyptic novel, but it's also, and definitely science fiction, but what we're hoping to do is kind of raise the literary bar a bit on that kind of writing and try to get all the sort of plot stuff that we love from that kind of a novel, but also add in, you know, all the sort of character development and, you know, language sort of attention that you get from a literary novel, you know, whatever strict literary genre writing. We also added in some Pomo fun. You know, we claimed Alexander Tuvim wrote the novel and that Okla Elliott and Roel Clement, or fictional versions of us, rather, to be more exact, translated it. The Okla Elliott and Roel Clement who translate it are in the Federated States of America after the Great Calamity. And, you know, they're at the recently rebuilt University of Illinois. And they're just translators of this fictional Alexander Tuvim. So basically we have a fictional author and then fictional versions of us who translated it. So again, we tried to raise the bar a little bit, sentence by sentence and character by character. So we added some kind of, you know, almost like David Foster Wallace kind of, you know, postmodern fun.
Well, it's interesting that you say that. What do you feel, you don't have to name any names if you don't want, but what do you feel is lacking in terms of literary quality in the traditional post-apocalyptic science fiction novel?
Well, I think what is generally called genre writing, though I hate that term, I think that it is, I mean, if we're talking a crime novel, a legal thriller, horror, whatever, sci-fi fantasy, I think that traditionally plot has been privileged over character development. And, you know, again, sentence by sentence sort of, you know, beautiful, lush writing, you know, I mean, you just don't find that as often. Now, someone could say that the literary genre, which is just one more genre to my mind, privileges language sometimes over plot, and that's why, you know, it's not as readily consumed by the public. And so, you know, the goal here is to do what's called slipstream and just bring the best of both worlds, basically. You know, like, why not have a plot and, you know, three-dimensional characters? Why not have a good plot and, you know, careful sentence writing, you know?
One of the things that I found interesting was that you have, and Mr. Clement, both of you in co-translating the novel, have a lot on your plate. How did you approach constructing the conceit of the novel while also constructing the narrative of the novel?
Well, the conceit, it's interesting. So years and years ago, we actually wrote an experimental play set kind of in a version of this world. We wrote a screenplay, then we decided it was too big for that. But the way the idea came about is we're just sort of chatting about, like, oh, let's write some kind of a play or screenplay thing. And Roel was like, well, let's set it in Hollywood. I was like, well, I don't know if I want to set something in Hollywood. What if we do what Bertolt Brecht did with The Rise and Fall of the City of Mahagoni, where he takes Nazi Berlin and, you know, gangland, you know, gangster era Chicago and blends them into one city and calls it Mahagoni. I was like, why not take, you know, Soviet Russia, Nazi Berlin, and Golden Age Hollywood and blend that into one place called Joshua City? And we both immediately jumped on the idea, you know, so... So that's how the conceit happened, and then as for writing it, we used so many different methods. We used Google Docs. There was times when we lived in different states, so we'd be on the phone a lot. Then we've been living here together in Illinois for the past 2 years, and so sometimes we'd write side by side, one of us pacing around, sort of, you know, spouting off ideas manically while the other one was typing. So we switched up the tactics a lot, and we switched up the conceit a lot. Like I said, it started out an experimental play, then a screenplay. And now, you know, a novel.
Oh, yeah, oh, definitely. I'm curious, what do you feel is the difference between the narrative of the piece in contrast with the conceit? Because you take on, you know, do you, Okla Elliott, take on several roles in the book. You're ostensibly the translator of the book. You're also in the guise of Alexander Tuvim, and you're in a million other kind of minds in the book. How did you navigate telling the story through a number of perspectives, which are in a way your own?
Well, I mean, it's interesting. I think it was a little bit easier to have two people writing it, because if you have a bunch of characters, it's a cliche to say we sort of build our characters out of ourselves or the people we know. But if you have two people who have two personalities and, you know, two sets of people they know, you know, it's easier to be like, oh, I would like to sort of roughly, you know, put these characteristics from whatever, this friend of mine, you know, one characteristic of me, one characteristic of a friend, one characteristic of a character in a TV show I like, and then we're all would do the same. And so we were able to sort of hodgepodge together a lot of different character types, I think, because of that.
You mentioned the world building. A lot of people, you know, are constructing severely alternate worlds, although I guess every writer is making their own world when they write any story. But you mentioned how, obviously, you're picking a lot from Soviet Russia, you're picking a lot from other places. What was your approach to building the unique world of Joshua City in the book?
I think in that case, especially when you're building an alternate history or whatever you want to call it, it's an interesting kind of exercise in following things to their logical conclusion, right? So it's like, well, if that were to happen, then that would mean this would happen, then this would have to be the case, right? And so you have to do a lot of that kind of thinking. It's like, well, would there... one thing that we dealt with was with gender issues, right? And so we're like, well, in this post-apocalyptic world, would they allow women in engineering school? Well, not very often, right? We have one character who's like, hey, try to be a woman in engineering here, because it's already bad in contemporary America. So imagine a post-apocalyptic world, right? And so we set those sorts of things up, you know, some of the gender issues, and then immigrant issues, because there's the seven cities. Joshua City is one of seven, and so they're immigrants from other cities. And Joshua City's kind of the America, as it were. It's the richest and most technologically advanced. And so we dealt with some racism, too. We have, you know, some immigrants from Baekyeong-do, which is another city, which is, you know, vaguely Korean-based. I love their culture. I've studied some Korean language and culture, so we funhouse mirrored that a little bit. And so, again, it's a lot about just following things to their logical conclusion. Like, if this were to happen, would this be the case, or would this other thing be the case? And just sitting down and, like, you know, be honestly letting the dominoes fall where they would.
One thing that I really loved about the book is that even though, complicated is the wrong word, because that sounds imposing, but it's extremely well thought out, but you made it extremely accessible. Because the book, even though we talked about genre and you mentioned you wanted to raise the bar, the book, it's a prison break novel, it's a road novel, it's a book about revolution, it's a disease thriller in some ways, and clearly an alternate, you know, future history book. What are the ways in which, you know, including language, that you raised the bar on this and made it accessible while also making it complicated and complex?
Well, okay, so I have a little pet theory that I hope isn't too complicated, but I think that there's two ways to do complexity in literary writing. You can front-load it real heavy, right? So someone like Thomas Pynchon or Gaddis, right, they front-load their complexity, so to just like on the surface, to break through, just even reading a whole paragraph sometimes is hard, right? But then there's another way to do it, which is to backload it, right? So have your sentences be clean and, you know, breezy to read, but then it's like, you know, later when you're, you know, whatever, in the shower, eating dinner or whatever, you're still thinking about, why did that character do that? Or what an interesting little image that was, you know? And so what we try to do is backload as much of our complexity as possible and make the surface language as inviting as possible, while not dumbing it down at all. I don't think, you know, someone like, I don't know, John O'Hara or Joyce Carol Oates, I mean, they're eminently readable, yet I don't think anyone's going to say they're not complex writers. So I think that's the real key there, is backloading that complexity And you know, also, since we are trying to play with the genre aspects, you know, the science fiction genre aspects, you know, we want it to be, you know, readable. And so there's also ways to construct paragraphs, right? I mean, you know, don't write three-page paragraphs that are all one sentence. You know what I'm saying? Again, Gaddis or... That. Yeah, I mean, I love some writers who do it. I mean, again, Gaddis, Gass, Volman, these are some of my favorite writers, but we didn't want that kind of a novel for this, you know?
Well, one of the things that I thought made the book extremely readable, which is kind of like when they call a soda drinkable, and you're like, right. Well, of course it's drinkable. But what made the book readable is the way that you and Mr. Clement kind of fast forward through certain things, but you know when to pause. For example, when Adrian is in he's taking care of people in the hospital toward the middle of the book. And he's waiting out the month to see if he wants to stay. That part, you know, we don't need to see every minute of that time, that deliberation period. But I really, really loved the subplot with I was thinking Arya.
Yeah, Arya, but yeah.
Arya, yeah.
That's how I choose to pronounce it. But I mean, it's, you know, whatever.
Yeah, that's cool.
It's an alternate world. You can pronounce it any way you want.
I really loved that the way that you slow down on those moments, and even though we're not seeing every moment of his day as he decides what he wants to do, instead we're getting all that information in the context of a kind of love story.
Right. Well, I mean, so medical science, as we call it there, plays a big role because, you know, our two main characters, Nicholas Kowalski and Adrian Talbot, are medical scholars, as we call them, at Joshua University. And then, as you say, Adrian goes out and helps in this hospital out in the desert. And so, you know, we wanted to have and we did a lot of medical research and tried to do things like find, well, what was heart medicine like in 1971? Because this world wouldn't be as advanced as ours technologically or, you know, medically. And so we did a lot of research on, like, early heart transplant stuff and tried to recreate that, but also change it a bit, because the way they would create that science would be different. But we didn't want to get bogged down, and we didn't want to turn it into, like, a science text, you know. And so those sorts of things that I like to think add a little bit of authority when someone's really done their research on those matters. But I've read some what's called hard sci-fi that gets so bogged down in their scientific facts that it feels like a textbook. So yeah, it's hard to find that balance, and we struggle with that. But also, I mean, any writer deals with, you know, when to, you know, do exposition and when to do scene, right? You'll recall Erin McGraw at Ohio State University. She had a great, and actually. She gets a reference for this in the novel, actually. But she used to say a thing in class, like, remember when your parents used to tell you don't make a scene when you're at a restaurant and you're a little kid? What they mean is don't draw attention to us. And so her point was that a scene should only come in when you want to draw attention. So the default mechanism should actually be exposition. Just tell us what's going on, and then when you want to draw attention to something, that's when you stop and make a scene. And so we use that sort of dictum as our measure for when to stop and actually show an operation. You know, okay, well, this one we actually want to see. Okay, we can say, oh, Adrian did this, this, and this on throughout that week. You know, just sort of do it all exposition. Yeah, he met with this kind of a wounded soldier, this kind of a sick, you know, child, da-da-da. Then, oh, no, this one matters. Let's slow down and do it blow by blow. And so that was sort of the formula we used.
Yeah, I tend to think of it as the kind of shiny thing principle. You're walking along the street, it's a boring day, but the shiny things, you know, metaphorically in life are the things that you want to commit to paper, not the mundane things. If you don't mind, obviously we'll talk more about the novel. I want to reflect what you said through the lens of one of your short stories. You had a collection published by Press 53, a very cool independent press. And in a story like The Long Walk Home, you describe a veteran coming home from war. And it seemed to me, while you were speaking, that you did the same kind of thing where, you know, the flight is the same as everything else, and you know, and it's not interesting. You had to cast the coming home of the protagonist Reynolds, demonstrate what happened to him as he finally came home, the long walk home. So it's all about, like you said, figuring out which bits of the day, you know, and of the story are the ones that you want to cast attention on. Is there a difference when you're writing a shorter piece than a much longer piece in deciding what shiny things, what scenes you want to give the reader?
I mean, so a short sort of facile answer would just be no. You know, you have to use the same basic logic, but a more considered answer, I think, would have to take in genre. I mean, I think about genre constantly. And the genre, I mean, that's like maybe in manuscript form, I think that story was like 17 pages, you know what I'm saying? Whereas right. The novel in manuscript form was 958 pages.
So,
I mean, you're going to have, I mean, in a big novel like that, you're just going to have to do a little bit more exposition. Whereas a short story, almost in and of itself, is like, you know, the day unlike any other, just to keep referencing our Ohio State faculty, Lee Martin used to always say that, you know, a short story, the reason why, you know, or your shiny thing, this was the shiny day, or this was the day that stood out. But as Lee Martin used to put it, the day unlike any other, right? And so, you know, so as I say, a more considered answer is like, and if you look at that story, there's definitely, you know, plenty of exposition. But I'm going to say that story, I mean, it's been years, but I'm going to say it's like 75% scene, whereas the novel is maybe 50% scene. Just because you got to get a lot more data out, especially, once again, and when you're bringing in those science fictional and post-apocalyptic elements, sometimes you just got to let the reader know what the world's like. And you can do that through scene, and you definitely do that through scene. But every so often, you just got to give them a paragraph of, okay, look, this is what this was like. And so I think the in this sense of the word genre, from short story to novel, I do think that, and especially talking about this specific, you know, the Doors You Mark Your Own, that novel, and The Long Walk Home, that short story specifically, I think the short story there sort of demanded a bit more scene. I will say, interestingly, it's interesting that you picked that one out. If you look at the acknowledgments, Raoul helped me a lot with that story, to the point where I give him co-authorship on that story, too. So it's all the other stories in the novella in that collection are, you know, mine. I was about to say 100% mine, but that's nonsense. So many friends help you edit, so you're always collaborating. But that story was so role influenced that if you look at the acknowledgments, I actually give him co-authorship on that story. So it's interesting that you picked that one out, since obviously again, I co-wrote The Doors You Mark Your Own.
I'm looking now. Oh yeah. Oh, it is interesting that I picked that out. Yeah. You mentioned that you collaborated with him on The Long Walk Home.
No, of course.
Pleasure.
I mean, one of the things that I always point out is, you know, every story in that collection and every poem practically that I've written in the past decade, and same for Raoul, we're each other's first editor on everything. This is why we were able to write a novel together. People are always asking, like, how can you write a novel with someone? And I always say, well, I couldn't do it with anyone else. Because, you know, he and I are like, are each other's first go-to for everything literary. And so we always joke that we have a hive mind about these things. You know, the number of times I mentioned we'd be like typing side by side, and you know, either I'd be the one pacing around or he'd be the one pacing around, and he would say something or I would say something, and the other one had typed, I mean, literally the exact words that the person just said, but like a second before they said them. And we'd just be like, look, hi, and we had always made a joke, you know, the hive doth thrive, you know. So it's interesting that you picked that one out, because I think, but as I say, every single poem, I mean, in The Cartographer's Ink, which came out in my poetry collection, there's not a poem in there that he didn't edit three times, you know. And same thing, every poem or story he's published, I've edited two or five times. So even those things that don't bear a double byline, you know, we're just all over each other's work, and everyone has two or three friends like that that, you know, they show their work to. So I don't know. I think the sort of lone artist is a little bit of a romantic capital R idea that's a bit of hogwash to my mind, because we all collaborate in so many ways.
Well, interesting. Can you think of an idea that that Mr. Clement just knocked down of yours, like a time where he, you know, probably rightly, you know, said no, let's not do that.
That's specific example is actually hard to come up with because we both, like what would happen is it'd be a sort of like, he would throw out an idea and be like, well, let's have Nicholas do this. I'm like, no, I don't think that's believable. He's like, yeah, but I like this idea about it. I'm like, okay, well, let's keep that idea or that aspect of what you said, and then let's add this. He's like, yeah, I dig that. And then, you know, so 5 minutes later, whoever came up with the first idea, it's like it gets real fuzzy, you know what I'm saying? Because we just sort of Voltron together.
There you go, yeah.
You know, each different idea, and I'd be like, oh, well, to keep the Voltron metaphor, I'm like, well, let's take that arm off and put this other blue arm on, you know? So I guess what I would say is both of us knocked down and built up practically every single idea. One big one, I guess, was that we had about 70 pages of backstory on Vivian and Abraham, two of the characters in the Dorothy Mark Hirona husband-wife team. Vivian is a famous actress, and Abraham is the greatest engineer who develops these trains that become almost mythologized in the Joshuan culture. We had about 70 pages of backstory on them, and then very painfully had to cut it, and you know, and that was like in part one of the novel, and we reduced it to about 20 pages and made it backstory in part three because we just felt like it made part one too long, and it suddenly became this domestic drama. But that was a hard one, you know. That was tough. And again, there was one of these things where we went back and forth, and eventually just had to decide, yeah, that those pages have to go.
Well, what do you think is a skill that you feel that you have, and a skill that you feel he has?
It's interesting. I feel one thing that I know that happened a lot is especially when we're on the phone, when we're living in he's in North Carolina, I was in Illinois, is that like whatever, he'd be writing on something and he'd hit a certain roadblock, and I'd be like, well, what if we just restructure it like this, and then within like, you know, 20 minutes, you know, the roadblock's gone and the novel's moving forward again. So that's sort of like structuring of narrative, I felt like I brought a lot to the table, though of course he did too. I mean, he had lots of great structural ideas. Roel has an almost genius level ability to like describe a little scene. It's almost, it borders on like the Nabokovian, you know, the way that like he'll just like find exactly the right sort of descriptor for a thing that like you know exactly when the hand moves exactly that way, you know the person's sad without having to be like, you know, John moved his hand sadly. It's like the exact way he moved his hand, and you just know. And you feel it. I think he has, as I say, something that borders on the Nabokovian for that.
Oh, very cool. One of the things that I think elevated the novel above the typical genre stuff, even though, you know, we both love genre, were some of the ways that you condensed the narrative, but also shared it in an interesting way. For example, in part one, there's a really nice cinematic technique where Marchik's mother is writing a letter to him, and you intersperse a bit of narration in sections between, in the middle of the letter. So you're getting all that exposition out in the characterization, but you're also kind of metaphorically shifting the lens, you know, taking the camera and putting it somewhere else to cut things down a little bit. Another technique that you used are the footnotes. The book has, don't sound scared if you haven't read the book, but the especially toward the beginning, there are footnotes to disperse the exposition in an extremely fast manner. Were these conscious decisions to condense the exposition in this way? What else do you feel that you guys did?
Well, I'm glad that you point that out, because we didn't want to just always do what I call like a data dump, right? And that's one thing I find a lot in some of the more like, you know, again, I hate the term, but we got to use it as the language around us. Some of the more purely genre kind of writing that I love reading. I mean, even like, you know, infinite genius of Asimov, you know, Isaac Asimov, every so often he would just give you a page that was just like, okay, now I'm just going to tell you all this stuff and you're just going to have to deal with it, you know what I'm saying?
Right.
And every so often, that, like I said, it feels like a data dump. So we thought we would switch up the tactics. So we have, you know, these sort of governmental documents that will sometimes be brought in, and then Alexander Tuvum has the occasional footnote, but then the fictional Oakley Elliott and Ronald Clement as translators of Tuvum will every so often just jump in and be like, oh, you know, we had to translate that word this way because the way the culture worked then, and it, then suddenly in like three sentences you learn all this stuff about the culture, but again, it doesn't, we switched up the tactics for getting you that kind of data that you need when you're building a, you know, an alternate world. And so, yeah, we used, you know, Joshua City government documents, we used letters, we used footnotes from both the author and the fake author and fake translators. And then we use just, you know, classic, you know, and now we're going to give you a paragraph of exposition where you just learn that's what's up with the water or whatever. So I think the hope there, the very conscious hope, yes, if it was conscious, it certainly was, the hope was to switch up the tactics enough so it didn't feel like every 10 pages you were getting hit with, like, the same kind of technique for getting you that necessary information.
Yeah, definitely. I wonder if you feel that there's a difference in the speed of the narrative and the way that you felt composing it as you went along. Once that's how I felt reading it. Once the kind of exposition is out of the way and I understand the characters and what's going on and where they're living, the book read faster to me. Is it written faster metaphorically, or how does that work?
Well, I mean, I think you're right. I mean, one reviewer, Book List, gave us a pretty positive review, but then they made this one little thing like, you know, I think they phrased it as a lot of these, you know, big, you know, science fiction books go, it starts out a little slow, but it picks up speed. You know, like, reader, you know, don't stop reading. What's interesting is another reviewer actually preferred the first part, but whatever, reviewers are fickle. But I think you're right that it's just a function of developing a world. You know, at first you're like, where am I? And once you, it's almost like, you know, go be a tourist in, you know, Turkey or Germany or Egypt or something for a week. Your first day is just, you know, like, oh, well, where do I even get a sandwich? And then after 4 or 5 days, you're just walking down the street getting your sandwich. Oh, that's where I like to get my coffee, you know. And you know, going, you're almost a tourist in this new world when you read a big, you know, fantasy or sci-fi novel. And so it takes a little while to figure out the lay of the land. And then once you get it, then it's easier. And also, we have to do less work, right? I mean, early on, we have to tell you, oh, that's the name of that city. Oh, that's, you know, the language they speak. That's the economic situation over there. Here's the political situation in Joshua City. But after 50 or 100 pages, you kind of, again, basically know the lay of the land. You keep learning more and more things, and we travel out into the desert and, you know, the outer provinces, as we call them, in the second part of the novel. So you're still learning new parts of the world. But again, you kind of got your bearings. And so I think it's more of an effect of that. And I think it's true, as the Book List reviewer said, this is just true of, I mean, practically every science fiction or fantasy novel out there. It takes a little while to sort of, you know, if you're reading Harry Potter, it's like, how do the spells work, you know? Well, you know, it takes you 100 pages to know how the spells work, and then once you do, the writer doesn't have to give you as much information, so there's fewer words to read about that. But then even when they do, you're like, oh, yeah, I know that, and so you kind of breeze by it, as opposed to like, what? How does this work again? So I think it's just a function of the genre.
Yeah, I don't think the book starts out slowly. I think that you understand when you pick up a book, you know, of this kind of heft, you know what you're in for. You know, it's right. It's not, you're not going to read this and then take your kid to soccer practice because, you know, you won't have time. Right. But you will curl up on a, you know, a nice evening, get a cup of coffee and dig in. I think that's just something that we, you know, it's part of the deal.
Well, I mean, actually, and part of the plan of having it come out in mid-April, so it's coming out in like 2 weeks, is that, you know, the reviews will be coming out and people will be reading and stuff, but about a month after it comes out, school's out and it's summertime. And I do think this is the kind of book that, you don't read it on your lunch break and you're done. It's the kind of book that you're like, okay, I got a week off of work. I'm going to, you know, put my pajamas on and order a pizza and just like lie in bed all day and just sort of get immersed. And, you know, I love novellas, I love short stories, I love poetry. But, I mean, my favorite experience as a reader, and I hope we've created this for readers, is exactly that. Like, you know what? Today, I am doing nothing. I'm just going to read this thing and just, like, lose myself in this other world all day or all weekend or whatever, all spring break, all, you know, whatever.
Well, speaking of poetry and other worlds, I wanted to talk briefly about you do a lot of translation work.
Right.
And I was curious about your thoughts on translation, especially in the context of The Doors You Mark Are Your Own. When you translate, you're inherently trying to communicate another person's thoughts that were translated into words. You're trying to translate those through another language, through your own brain, into words in another language. What are your thoughts on the accuracy, the philosophy when you engage in such an act?
Well, I mean, first off, I mean, there's a reason why Umberto Eco, the great Italian novelist, anthologist, called translation the art of failure, because it is. I mean, translation is just not going to be perfect. But that's part of, I don't know, it's almost like that's why I love it. You know, it's like, I know I'm going to fail, but can I, you know, to keep quoting people, as Beckett says, can I fail better? You know what I'm saying? So you translate, you're like, oh, well, I can't quite get that bit of linguistic oddity. So I primarily translate Jürgen Becker, the German poet, and I have his selected shorter poems. It's coming out from Black Lawrence Press later this year. And, you know, he does, you know, as a lot of poets do, he does, like, you know, little linguistic oddities. And if the poet's doing his job right, or her job, in this case, a he, but whatever, if the poet, if poets are doing their job right, they're pushing their language to its boundaries, which means they're using every technique that language allows, and not every language allows the same techniques, right? So I'd be like, okay, well, he could do that in that line in German. I can't do that in that line in English, but in the next line, I can do something kind of like it. So it's almost like I owed him a syntactical oddity, and I just keep a ledger almost of what do I owe Becker's poem, you know? But it's great fun. I sometimes joke that, you know, some people do the New York Times Sunday crossword puzzle. I translate poetry. You know, it's so fun to try to, like, get those things to fit in and to, you know, how do you get them to work? And then also, like, how do you deal with, like, a cultural reference that, you know, that culture would totally get, but no one else would? So, I mean, if you say Cape Cod or Martha's Vineyard in, you know, the U.S., we all know, oh, okay, rich people are there. But, I mean, does someone in Germany know Martha's Vineyard from Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania? Probably not. You know what I'm saying? And so how do you deal with that? These terms that are loaded culturally, but you know, so then you give a quick little gloss, you know what I'm saying? The Ritzy blah blah blah, you know, if it's the name of a hotel that everyone would in that culture know is a Ritzy hotel. I mean, maybe you have to add a word so that the reader in the new culture gets the valence, you know. So no, it's a game of give and take, and it's a as I say, it is, you know, the art of failure, as Eco calls it.
And what's the kind of level of fluency that you feel a translating poet should have?
Well, this is one area where I am a little bit conservative, you know, because I mean, you know, I've been in Mexico, you know, several times, and my Spanish is decent. You know, I've studied French since I was like 18 years old, but I more or less don't let myself translate those languages I'm weaker in. You know, I have a degree in German. I lived in Germany for a full year, and I've been back a couple times. So I feel like you need a really high level, honestly. And this is why you get translating teams a lot, right? You'll get like a scholar who, you know, just knows the language perfectly, and then a really skilled poet in English, right? And they'll team up because there. I find that there the two ways translation can go wrong is that you end up with someone who's like, you know, he or she is just amazing at the language and the culture, but you know, it has never written a masterful poem in their own language. So they have really accurate, you know, translations, but they're also kind of bloodless. Or they can go the other way, right? Someone who doesn't know the language very well but is an excellent poet, and they just take all these crazy liberties or just make outright errors and end up with a beautiful poem. It's just not an accurate one. So no, I think you gotta, the bar is pretty high for me on that one. You gotta either team up and get both of those skills together, or you know, the one person has to have published some of their own work and actually really know the language.
Yeah, I agree with you. I do think that a poet or a, you know, a writer can get something interesting out of the misunderstandings they might have in the other language, as long as they're not kind of claiming that they're doing a translation. You know, it can. I guess it can be inspiring,
Right.
but maybe not so much a translation. Yeah, very cool. I like to ask people. You're very much a literary person, doing lots of things, living in Germany, not currently, but at times. And so you must have an independent bookstore or two, a place that you feel does that right. What are you thinking?
Here locally, I like Gene Adams Bookstore quite a bit. They sell used books and new books, but they're also super supportive of local authors. They'll, like, you just walk in and say, "Hey, I'm a local author. Here are two of my books," and they'll just write you a check for them and put them on the you know, local author stack. And obviously, I mean, University of Illinois has a lot of writers, so it's a nice stack that they have over there. And then also, you know, again, it's a beautiful little place too. You know, it's like you walk in, you're like, "Oh, I am happy to be here." You know, if you're having a bad day, you walk in, you're gonna have a better day. You know.
Oh, very much, yeah. There are. And I wanted to make sure that people know the Cartographers Inc. If you liked what Mr. Elliott said about poetry and about translation and language, definitely pick up his really interesting book, The Cartographers, Inc., published by NYQ Books recently, and it's on your website, so there's no point in not saying it, but a big fan of the book is Joyce Carol Oates herself. Then that must have felt really good to get validation from someone like that.
Well, I mean, first of all, she's one of my favorite writers. I probably own, I don't know, 30 or 40 of her books. It's almost an obsession to read her books. But also, she's part of my dissertation. But yeah, no, and it's interesting that you bring up the language stuff, because when she praised it on her Twitter page, you know, she read it and, you know, praised it publicly, which, yeah, I mean, I almost fainted, you know. But she talked about the, I'm surprised I don't have this memorized. I don't, but I'm kind of surprised. But
I have it in front of me if you want.
Do, because she says something about the languages thing, like the ease and through, you know what I'm saying? It's like,
yeah.
But even though it's all in English, somehow she intuited that, you know, I'm into translation and foreign languages or something, you know?
Yeah, she says, "Thanks to Okla Elliott for The Cartographer's Ink, which moves with unsettling ease through space/time/languages, a melancholy beauty."
Right, exactly, yeah, that's it, you know, that move through languages, you know, is, when I read it, it was interesting. I mean, I don't know what she knows about me, you know what I'm saying? She's probably a pretty busy lady. But I don't know if she even knows I'm a translator, but somehow she could smell on my own poetry that I spent a lot of time with poetry in other languages. So I thought that, I mean, of course, she's an observant and brilliant lady, so no mystery there. But I did think it was interesting that she sort of intuited that.
Yeah, one of the things that I don't have the book on hand, but one of the things that I love about your poetry is that it is accessible, and it's you know, again, readable, but it's also got that flavor of otherness in that kind of way that may have clued her into languages, because even though it's, you know, it's very easy to read, you're talking about, you know, living elsewhere, you're talking about people like smart scholar people from long ago. References that you know, that people either will get or look up. What's the mixture in terms of being understandable and being how do you approach language in a poem that gets people to understand but also challenges them?
This is interesting. This obviously came up earlier when we're talking about the novel and how we've, you know, added in all this sort of high literary stuff without, you know, trying to be off-putting in any way. And I think my little pet theory about you can front-load or back-load your complexity, and I just think you can be just as complex as, you know, whatever, James Joyce, without being as immediately impenetrable, you know what I'm saying? And again, I love Joyce. I love all these difficult authors. They're all over my bookshelves, and I've learned a lot from them. But if anything, one thing I learned is not a lot of people are going to be willing to, you know, read a 800-page prose poem, basically, you know, high lyricism for 800 pages. So I think my goal is, it's almost like a little challenge I give myself. Like, can I be as complex as William H. Gass, but as readable as Isaac Asimov in the novel? You know what I'm saying? And the same thing with the poetry, you know. I just don't see any reason. And I think some people do it... do that sort of like surface level difficulty to kind of show how smart and amazing they are or something. It's like they're begging you to see them that way. Whereas if, you know, some people get overlooked if they're a little more readable, but I think you can find a middle ground where, again, you can have certain difficulties on the surface, but also have a lot of inviting aspects to the surface.
Oh, very much. There are a few questions that I ask all the writers. First of all, how do you usually compose your first drafts? It may be different for you because you collaborate a lot, but what is that procedure generally like?
Once again, we have to come back to genre. Poems tend to, like, you know, since, first off, they're shorter. I mean, sometimes, I mean, if I write an 11-line poem, I'll just be walking down the street to get my cup of coffee, and bam, I've got a cool little idea. And that's half of the poem already. So those tend to come pretty fast. Otherwise, I'm a pretty slow writer. I try to write every day, but the actual pace of getting words on page is, you know, like 2 pages a day. You know what I'm saying? It's like nothing spectacular. So for a story or an essay, something a little bit longer, again, I do tend to get that flash of idea, and so I pound out those first couple pages pretty fast. Then I'm going to, like, slowly develop the rest of it. There's no way to talk about a novel, really. I mean, I'm working on a new novel now. I've got about 100 pages on it, called Salt of the Earth. It's sort of mixing crime legal writing with the literary genre again. Like, so it seems like all my novels are going to end up... Actually, I've never conceived of a purely literary novel, to be honest. There's always some genre element. I don't know why that is, because that's not true of my short stories, necessarily. So that's quite a bit different. So I think I have to, what might sound like a cop-out answer is it changes project to project and genre to genre so much that it's hard to give one template, as it were.
Oh, sure. And so once you have something down, what is your revision procedure as variable?
Yeah, I mean, well, okay, so of course I fail, like we all do, with our writing goals, but I more or less hit this, you know, 5 or 6 days a week, where I try to produce 2 new pages and edit 8 to 10 old ones. So I'm like, I'm editing as I'm writing constantly, and it'll get me back into the process. So especially with, like, a novel, what I'll do is I'll go, you know, so whatever I wrote on Monday, on Tuesday, I go, like, 3 or 4 pages back even before what I wrote on Monday, edit that, edit what I wrote on Monday, and then now I'm in the flow again, and then I get my 2 new pages, right? And then the next day, the goal is to go back, comb through all that yet again, get myself back into the flow, make changes as necessary, and then keep going forward. So it's a constant editing process. Then, of course, you know, with the longer project, you hit those awful moments where, like, you know, as I was saying earlier, where we had to cut 70 pages from Georgie Mark Your Own, and those moments, you know, it's just like, you know, you almost want to lie down in a fetal position and cry because you know, painstakingly created this huge movement, and you gotta cut it, you know. Sorry, you know. So that tends to be my process for prose. Poetry, I just read it. Since, again, I mean, I actually occasionally will write, like, the 10-page poem, but mostly I do the 1 to 4 pagers, you know. Right. And those, you just read beginning to end over and over again until, you know, they finally get right.
Very cool. Once you have a smaller piece ready to go in your view, what is your submission procedure generally like?
You know, I've been trying to get better about this over the years. Like, I know there are people who have, like, Excel spreadsheets for this stuff. I can't quite get there. But, I mean, you know, send it out to, you know, find the places that accept simultaneous submissions and shoot them out. I mean, I'm really bad about this stuff because, I mean, just recently I realized I have, like, 30 or 40 poems that I've, like, you know, edited, and they're as ready as they're going to be, and they've never been submitted once. I'm like, what are you doing, man? But then, you know, so then what happens is it's a lot of, it goes to extremes, right? So I'll kind of get angry at myself for having not done that, and then I'll sit down and make up, you know, a couple packets of poems. I'm like, I'm going to submit, like, to 30 places today, you know? And so I go crazy one day, and then it's like, you know, 4 months later, I'm like, dude, you know, be a good shepherd for your work, you know? I'm not particularly functional at it, but, like, what I'm working toward is just sort of constantly having, you know, submissions out, and as things come back, just send them out to another place. you'd asked about, you know, some any kind of like advice or whatever earlier for writers and stuff. I think the number one thing to do is just to develop the thickest skin ever. You know, I have a couple friends who are really talented writers, and they send stuff out, and they just, for whatever reason, people aren't picking it up. I don't get it. And I feel like I've been really lucky, you know. I mean, when I do sit down and do my, like, okay, this weekend I'm going to submit, you know, to 30 places or whatever, I get pretty good returns on that. And I feel like I've just been lucky. I mean, and this isn't any false modesty. I mean, I feel like my stuff did deserve to get published, or it wouldn't have been. But I have friends, I'm like, and I'm like, yeah, that's just as good. Why is no one picking that up? So I think you have to sort of, everyone has to admit the total randomness of this stuff. You know what I'm saying? It's like, if the person reading the slush pile that day is hungover, or, you know, her boyfriend or his girlfriend just, like, you know, or whatever, you know, if they just went through a breakup, or they just found someone that just fell in love for, you know, and you send them a love poem, like, okay, well, that's going to be different, right? If they just, you know, had a horrible breakup, like, screw love, screw this poem, you know? If they're like, oh, life is beautiful, I just found Bob, you know? And the slush pile reader's thinking of Bob, and, you know, how he or she loves Bob so much. And then you hit them with this beautiful love poem. They're like, that's exactly how I feel about Bob. I'm going to publish that. You know, I mean, I don't know if it's quite that random, but I mean, it kind of is, you know?
It's very much a mixture of the preparation and the hard work and a little bit of luck in the numbers game.
Exactly. That's exactly a numbers game. That's why every so often I get angry at myself and just, like, sit down and submit like a madman over one weekend, because I know it's a numbers game. You send out a short story once to the New Yorker, okay, your odds are slim.
Yeah,
you know what I'm saying. But if you send it to the Mid-American Review and Hayden's Fair Review and Black Warrior Review and, you know, seven others, and throw the New Yorker in there for fun, okay, well, your odds just went up drastically. You know what I'm saying?
Sure.
So it's just, yeah, it you know, you got to do the hard work. But then you have to admit it's also a numbers game. And so you got to be a good shepherd for your own work, but you also have to just not take it as a reflection on yourself. Because, like I said, I do. I mean, I know a lot of writers, and I not all of us are, you know, getting all that lucky. And I've watched people just sort of be like, you know, no one's ever going to publish my stuff, and then just stop submitting for like a year. I'm like, no, that's the opposite of what you need to do.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
You know, you get three rejections, okay, send out six more. You know what I'm saying? Like, it's resilience and perseverance, you know?
Oh, definitely. And you have been in a bunch of dream journals yourself for other people, but is there that dream journal that you really want to be in, Dream Magazine?
You know, it's crazy, man, but it's Alaska Quarterly Review for me. Yeah, Alaska Quarterly, man.
They're great.
Yeah, I mean, and they're amazing, but it's like, I think a lot of people might say, oh, Paris Review. Don't get me wrong, I'd love to be in Paris Review. If the editors of Paris Review are listening right now, give me a call. But but it's like when I've submitted to Paris Review like twice in my life, but Alaska Quarterly like a dozen times, and they just won't. And they give me a nice rejection. They say, hey, we really like this. But yeah, I don't know why I do know why I love that journal, because I've bought, you know, a couple dozen copies of it over the past decade, and just hands down, just like everything in there is just always amazing. And so I've gotten weirdly obsessed, and probably because they continue to reject me over and over and over again. I'm like, no, you must be mine.
They're not my number one rejected journal, but they're up there. But they, because they do excellent work, you know, you keep trying with them.
Mm-hmm.
Very cool. Yeah. What's one of your, because, you know, you're always doing a lot of stuff, do you have any narrative guilty pleasures like reality TV or Breaking Bad or anything like that?
I mean, I watch Netflix like it's my job, and also I use it for research, or I tell myself maybe, that I do a lot of research with it. So when we're writing a Dorothy Mark Your Own, you know, I mean, I watched every single sci-fi TV show and movie on Netflix and Amazon Prime possible, you know. And now that I'm working on this crime legal, you know, literary, you know, novel, I'm watching, you know, I recently watched the TV show Philly, which it breaks my heart. I only got one season. It's such a great show. And I'm watching The Good Wife right now, too. Like, it's my job. Yeah, it's a great show. And it's one of those shows that's like, again, it blends. I mean, it's legally as accurate as any TV show is going to be. You know what I'm saying? I mean, they take liberties because you have to sometimes. But it's pretty legally accurate. But it's also just so dramatically rich. I mean, it's kind of like The Wire, which is another show I love. I mean, that's a crime show, like The Sopranos is a crime show, but they've raised the bar to be as good as any Pulitzer Prize winning novel, you know what I'm saying? So in a way, I almost have too many guilty pleasures to name. But yeah, I do a lot of Netflix watching. It's also kind of how I reward myself at the end of the day, you know?
Oh yeah, you definitely unwind that way. Who are some of you, you've worked with many great people, both as student and teacher, but who are some of the mentors that you've had along the way?
Well, I mean, Lee Martin, who is, I would consider one of my mentors, I used to joke every essay I ever workshopped in one of his classes ended up published, so I need to, like, just, you know, go to a Lee Martin workshop every so often, and you know, my nonfiction career will blow up. But Lee used to joke that I was the fastest person to ever accept admission to OSU's MFA program, and it's because that was my number one program, because Andrew Hudgens is, to my mind, one of the, like, he's one of three or four greatest poets. And it turns out he's also a great teacher. You know, I mean, that doesn't always mix, right? You can be a great writer and kind of suck as a teacher. But so for, but then Lee K. Abbott's there as well. So it's like those three guys definitely are my sort of triumvirate. But I mentioned Erin McGraw earlier, too. And she, you know, taught me so much. I said she gets a reference in the novel. Alexander Tuvim sort of parrots some of her literary thinking, as I mentioned earlier. So I would say that probably those four, like, really, you know, developed me a lot as a writer at Ohio State. Some people, I find that, I mean, in this whole MFA debate thing that goes on constantly, annoyingly, one thing that people don't talk about is, like, a lot of people talk trash about their MFA experience. You know what I'm saying? It's like, do you do an MFA or not? Are you a real writer or not? And then people just keep going back and forth with those two stupid ideas. But, I mean, it's like, really, almost no one praises their MFA program, and I just, it's almost like they should be paying me how much I praise that program, because, I mean, Andrew taught me so much about poetry, you know, the two Lees, Lee K. Abbott and Lee Martin, taught me so much about prose, and, you know, both fictional and non-fictional, and then Erin McGraw taught me tons. I mean, actually, the novella in From the Crooked Timber was workshopped in her class, so that was a big... First of all, it was a big commitment on her part to tackle that with me. I would say those people are definitely mentors. I just have a lot of buddies, too, as I say. You know, David Bowen started American Press with. You know, he and I talk about literature all the time, so that's more of a peer thing. Same thing with Raoul. So, yeah, I mean, that's another place where I just feel like I've just been really lucky. I went to OSU to work with, you know, a handful of people and found even more people I wanted to work with, and they were all amazing. Then... yeah, I have just, like, a ton of really, really good friends. I mean, Kyle Miner and I have collaborated on things before, and we've traded work off, and we, you know, just support each other in every way we can. And that, again, that's rare. A lot of writers are, you know, basically, like, petty backstabbers. You know, something about the artist ego or something. But also, I mean, like, my friend Jillian Viza, you know, I mean, she's just, you know, ever since I met... I don't know if I should tell the story, but I will. But I remember when I was living in Greensboro, she got a poem in Atlantic Monthly, and you would think she was in her MFA program there at the time, and I was doing another master's at the time. You know, she got a poem in Atlantic Monthly, and you would think that everyone would just, like, be going crazy high-fiving her in the hallway, you know what I'm saying, confetti through the air.
Be thrilled, yeah.
But instead, it was not exactly ostracized, but it was just like, it was like, okay, that happened, whatever. I was like, you know, to hell with that. So I threw her a big party, you know what I'm saying? It's like... And so I think sometimes people do get petty about those sorts of things, you know. Someone gets lucky or, you know, works harder or whatever, and then they get a little jealous or something. But I would like to encourage anyone listening, don't be that person. You know what I'm saying? If your friend gets something good, buy them a taco and high-five them. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, not to totally toot the horn of the Ohio State program. You know, we both attended, and I'm sure that there were lapses from everybody on occasion because we're human. I always sensed a lot of support from people, and I've always been genuinely pleased and overjoyed when people have gotten fantastic success. It's not a zero sum game.
Right, exactly. I mean, I that's one of the things I could have predicted it, but one of the things I will say that's really great about the Ohio State MFA program is that they really foster that kind of thing. You know, if someone gets good news, they send it out over the listserv, and you know, there is kind of high-fiving in the hallway, you know, when someone gets into a great journal, you know, or gets a book contract. as you say, there are lapses, and there are different personalities, so, you know, it's not 100%, but you're not going to get that in any human endeavor. But, yeah, I mean, it's one of those programs that, you know, and then people talk about some other programs that are great, but I hear stories of just, like, really brutal competition, and it's like, well, that's not the environment I want to be in, even if it's, you know, whatever, you know, equally well-ranked as Ohio State, or even better ranked, I'd rather be in that supportive environment.
Yeah, there's so much rejection and so much negativity inherent in writing. I don't like spreading it to other people, which is why I do, you know, all this Great Writers Steal stuff. We have the most important question, which is also the last one. What should we look for next from Okla Elliott?
Well, first, I would like to thank you for doing all the good work you do for writers like myself. You've been really supportive, so thank you. You're an excellent literary citizen.
Oh, thank you, yeah.
What to look for next? Well, I guess in 2 weeks, look for my novel. but then in December, I have the book of actual translation coming out. And as I say, I'm hoping that I can get this new novel, Salt of the Earth, done, or at least a draft of it done by the end of the year, and then start shopping it around. There's some talk of film rights for The Doors You Mark Your Own, so maybe you're going to be looking for a TV show or something, but that's up in the air right now. But, you know, the agent is optimistic, she says.
Oh, yeah, honestly, the book does lend itself well to that. It's it has that kind of Game of Thrones feel, although it's clearly not the exact same thing at all. Just that it's a vast canvas on which you've painted a lot of interesting characters. So I wouldn't be surprised if that does come together.
Yeah, I mean, again, as I say, it kind of started out as a screenplay, then it got too big for that, so it became a novel. So in a weird way, we were already thinking filmically as we were writing the novel. And yeah, as you say, it's a big canvas. So I'd be interested to see what a team of writers are doing. Actually, a good friend of mine, Jason Williamson, and I there's an agent that wants us to, you know, do a pilot, teleplay, and, you know, do sort of like a synopsis for like a whole season. And we're going to be pitching that in May when I'm in New York. For the book tour for the novel, so hopefully someone will buy it.
Well, we definitely wish you all the best of luck. Okla Elliott, the author, co-author of The Doors You Mark Are Your Own from Dark House Press, an imprint of Curbside Splendor. The book is available for pre-order currently. You'll likely be listening to this after it is released. So go out and pick up that book. So again, thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you for having me, man.
I think you'll agree that we've learned a lot from Okla Elliott in the interview. I guess the main thing is to just keep working. No matter how downtrodden we get, no matter how bad we feel about what we're doing, we need to have that faith. We need to keep putting that next word on the paper, that next sentence, that next line, no matter what you're working on. I hope I've helped you just a little bit to improve your work. I'm Kenneth Nichols with Great Writers Steal. Remember, Shakespeare did it, so should you.